Chapter 21, Essays on the Gita, was published on the 15th of April, 1918, in the journal Arya. The issue opened with the Life Divine, the order of the worlds, then this essay, and then in Synthesis of Yoga, Love and the Triple Path. The determinism of nature. Let's note that the idea of determinism is a phrase or an English term in philosophy that was originated by Sir William Hamilton in the early middle part of the 19th century to distinguish fatalism from the position that Thomas Hobbes was taking in his vision of things. What it means essentially, determinism, what it means essentially is that things could not have happened except as they did. An inevitability in the process of nature then. Whether the agent as an individual in the cosmic scheme has any scope of freedom is the big question, and it's been argued from Plato and Aristotle all the way to this day as to what is it. Sri Aurobindo has his own view, which has been articulated in The Life Divine, especially. But here, as has been noted elsewhere, he is focusing on what the Bhagavad Gita has to say about determinism, not necessarily his perspective here. I do want to mention that Katie Sethna, one of the early and most brilliant philosophically minded disciples of Sri Aurobindo, wrote an article which was gathered and published in this book I'll hold it up, you see it, The Vision and Work of Sri Aurobindo. There's a piece in here which begins on page 91, Free Will in Sri Aurobindo's Vision. It's of interest because I guess a question had been posed. Sri Aurobindo perhaps didn't have time to answer it. Sethna took the issue up, and Sri Aurobindo said it could not be bettered. We may, at the end of the essay, come back and talk about what was in Sethna's article, but I think at this moment, let's go forward with Sri Aurobindo's examination of the ideas that appear in the Gita. And you'll see that he's been moving, if you remember, through chapter 5 and some in chapter 6, etc. Here we're backing up to chapter 3. So, the determinism of nature. When we can live in the higher self, by the unity of works and self-knowledge, we become superior to the method of the lower workings of Prakriti. We are no longer enslaved to nature and her gunas, but one with the Ishvara, the master of our nature, we are able to use her without subjection to the chain of karma for the purposes of the divine will in us. For that is what the greater self in us is. He is the Lord of her works and unaffected by the troubled stress of her reactions. Well, setting the genders aside there, the idea is that the nature is a presentation of the internal power and existence of the Supreme, who as a conscious person, here in the Gita, it's seen as the Purushottama, as Ishvara, as Krishna embodied. In the tradition of the Divine Mother, it would be the Devi, the Mahadevi, who would be affecting this. But the idea is that if we're yoked to the Supreme in our consciousness, then we are free by definition of that identity. Sri Aurobindo continues, because here the idea is that the soul engrossed in nature is not free. So he writes, the soul ignorant in nature, on the contrary, is enslaved by that ignorance to her modes, because it is identified there, not felicitously with its true self, not with the divine who is seated above her, but stupidly and unhappily with the ego mind, which is a subordinate factor in her operations in spite of the exaggerated figure it makes, a mere mental knot and point of reference for the play of the natural workings. To break this knot, no longer to make the ego the center and beneficiary of our works, but to derive all from and refer all to the divine supersoul, is the way to become superior to all the restless trouble of nature's modes. For it is to live in the supreme consciousness, of which the ego mind is a degradation, and to act in an equal and unified will and force, and not in the unequal play of the gunas, which is a broken seeking and striving, a disturbance, an inferior maya. Well, with the first paragraph, you can see the difference between the take that Western philosophy has about the nature of determinism, thinking that, well, all of this is occurring within the belt of one kind of existence, to the Vedantic view of the Bhagavad Gita. There is this world, Prakriti, yes, and everything moving within the triple world of the gunas is pushed around by Prakriti, but there is also a higher nature, Paraprakriti, which is identical with the Supreme Being, and of which the lower nature is a partial manifestation. So, in a sense, waiting for the God and Goddess inside to come out into the universe. And it seems that the individual soul, not the ego, not the ahankara, not the buddhi, but the real soul, could be the agent for that discovery of the truth of nature. First, there must be the truth of self. He continues, the passages in which the Gita lays stress on the subjection of the ego soul to nature have by some been understood as the enunciation of an absolute and a mechanical determinism which leaves no room for any freedom within the cosmic existence. Certainly the language it uses is emphatic and seems very absolute, but we must take here as elsewhere the thought of the Gita as a whole, and not force its affirmations in their solitary sense, quite detached from each other, as indeed every truth, however true in itself, yet taken apart from others which at once limit and complete it, becomes a snare to bind the intellect and a misleading dogma. For in reality, each is one thread of a complex weft, and no thread must be taken apart from the weft. And so we're talking about the bigger picture here that we'll see completely enunciated when we get to the 18th chapter. But now we're going backwards from the 6th to the 3rd to look more closely at what it means to be a being doing works in the fields of space and time, and yet born from divine regions. Everything in the Gita is even so interwoven and must be understood in its relation to the whole. The Gita itself makes a distinction between those who have not the knowledge of the whole, akritsna vidha, and are misled by the partial truths of existence, and the yogin who has the synthetic knowledge of the totality, kritsnavit, chapter 3, shloka 29. To see all existence steadily and see it whole and not be misled by its conflicting truths is the first necessity for the calm and complete wisdom to which the yogin is called upon to rise. A certain absolute freedom is one aspect of the soul's relations with nature at one pole of our complex being. A certain absolute determinism by nature is the opposite aspect at its opposite pole. And there is also a partial and apparent, therefore, an unreal eidolon of liberty which the soul receives by a contorted reflection of these two opposite truths in the developing mentality. It is the latter to which we ordinarily give, more or less inaccurately, the name of free will. But the Gita regards nothing as freedom which is not a complete liberation and mastery. So again, you can live free and do works free of karma if you have found your soul, if you have identified the Atman within you as distinct from the play of nature outside your real essence. And if you find that, by moving upwards to the higher nature, you can discover your unity with the Supreme, or you can discover at the core of your being this Supreme seated there in your secret heart. These are the steps that lead to liberation. Go deeply within or go high above. Don't stay stuck in mere phenomena, chasing them, chasing the gunas, because you can't win that game. And you can't wrestle the ego into submission. And you can't beat desire down. You have to identify with your deeper soul to be free of all of these things. You do train your being through the exercise of tapasya to distance yourself from egoism, from desire. But these are the training wheels on a bicycle. Ultimately, your concentration, your consciousness has to identify with that real being. So here we go, this great thing. And the Gita and Vedanta has the capacity, because of its larger metaphysical basis, to step beyond this antinomy which haunts the dualism of Western systems, that if there is a divine, and yet there is determinism, if all things are functionally delivered to their right proper place by the ordering of nature, and the divine, however you name him, is capable of entirety of vision, and so can see all the past, all the present, and all the future in one glance, then why permit beings to fall into chaos, into disorder, to be compelled and pushed around, and allowed to think that they are free when they are not? This is part of the general problem of theodicy. But the Gita and Vedanta does not have this because of the structure of its metaphysical system. And the structure of its metaphysical system is based upon deeper spiritual experience. And you'll remember that's where Sri Aurobindo goes for ultimate knowledge. It's based on one's own identity. Knowledge by identity with that which you seek. Not thinking about it, not cogitating over it, not wondering, but identifying. I'll stop. We have always to keep in mind the two great doctrines which stand behind all the Gita's... I'll start again. We have always to keep in mind the two great doctrines which stand behind all the Gita's teachings with regard to soul and nature. The Sankhya truth of the Purusha and Prakriti, corrected and completed by the Vedantic truth of the threefold Purusha and the double Prakriti, of which the lower form is the Maya of the three gunas and the higher is the divine nature and the true soul nature. So Sankhya is dualistic and Vedantic is unified. This is the key which reconciles and explains what we might have otherwise to leave as contradictions and inconsistencies. There are, in fact, different planes of our conscious existence, and what is practical truth on one plane ceases to be true because it assumes a quite different appearance as soon as we rise to a higher level from which we can see things more in the whole. Recent scientific discovery has shown that man, animal, plant, and even the metal have essentially the same vital reactions, and they would therefore, if each has a certain kind of what, for want of a better word, we must call nervous consciousness, possess the same basis of mechanical psychology. Yet, if each of these could give its own mental account of what it experiences, we should have four quite different and largely contradictory statements of the same reactions and the same natural principles, because they get, as we rise in the scale of being, a different meaning and value and have to be judged by a different outlook. So it is with the levels of the human soul. What we now call in our ordinary mentality, our free will, and have a certain limited justification for so calling it, yet appears to the yogin who has climbed beyond and to whom our night is day and our day night, not free will at all, but a subjection to the modes of nature. He regards the same facts, but from the higher outlook of the whole knower, Krishnavit, while we view it all together from the more limited mentality of our partial knowledge, akritsnavidha, which is an ignorance. What we vaunt of as our freedom is to him bondage. So the enlightened condition of the Western philosopher is still abject ignorance to the sage. The perception of the ignorance of our assumption of freedom, while one is all the time in the meshes of this lower nature, is the viewpoint at which the Gita arrives, and it is in contradiction to this ignorant claim that it affirms the complete subjection of the ego's soul on this plane to the gunas. While the actions are being entirely done by the modes of nature, it says, he whose self is bewildered by egoism thinks that it is his I which is doing them. But one who knows the true principles of the divisions of the modes and of works realizes that it is the modes which are acting and reacting on each other, and is not caught in them by attachment. Those who are bewildered by the modes get attached to the modes in their works. Dull minds, not knowers of the whole, let not the knower of the whole disturb them in their mental standpoint. Giving up thy works to me, free from desire and egoism, fight, delivered from the fever of thy soul. This is chapter 3, shlokas 27 through 30. And note that important point in there. Let not the knower of the whole disturb them in their mental standpoint. If those who are deluded, who are small in vision, are not interested in a higher perspective, have no aspiration for it, are not capable of seeing it, it is an injury, a psychological injury to them, to try to pull them out against their will. That means much to us, because we can encourage, we can entice, we can make the world a better place in which to learn lessons so that growth may be quickened, but we have not the right to compel. That's a kind of moral, perhaps even a spiritual violence. One might lead by example and by influence better than by instruction, but to become oneself what one aspires to be, that's our first work. Not to drive another. So look again how that shloka closes. Giving up your works to me. By consecrating the work that one does, by not owning it anymore, you become free from desire. You become free from self-regarding vision that I'm doing this and I'm offering and hoping I'm going to get something back for it. Simply, the giving is what you do more and more. And what happens is that peace comes to you, because no more are you feverishly fighting for your own, but now you're simply offering to the divine in whatever instance, whatever circumstance you are in, because you begin to see that every moment offers a possibility of service. And you take it up gladly because, this is my joy to give. Here, there is a clear distinction between two levels of consciousness, two standpoints of action, that of the soul, caught in the web of its egoistic nature and doing works with the idea, but not the reality of free will, under the impulsion of nature, and that of the soul delivered from its identification with the ego, observing, sanctioning, and governing the works of nature from above her. We speak of the soul being subject to nature. But on the other hand, the Gita, in distinguishing the properties of the soul and nature, affirms that while nature is the executrix, the soul is always the Lord, Ishvara. It speaks here of the self being bewildered by egoism, but the real self to the Vedantin is the divine, eternally free and self-aware. 1328. What then is this self that is bewildered by nature, this soul that is subject to her? The answer is that we are speaking here in the common parlance of our lower or middle view of things. We are speaking of the apparent self, of the apparent soul, not of the real self, not of the true Purusha. It is really the ego which is subject to nature, inevitably, because it is itself part of nature, one functioning of her machinery. But when the self-awareness in the mind consciousness identifies itself with the ego, it creates the appearance of a lower self, an ego self. This is that nexus between the buddhi, the intelligent will above, and the ahankara, the I-maker, the ego-maker, just below in the whole chain of nature. Remember how it begins with mahas, with buddhi at the top, stretching all the way down to gross objects, So this is rather a refined condition of nature, simply to create the nexus between the intelligent will and the ego. That's already a state. It takes a long time to get back to that as you begin to evolve from the inconscience of Prakriti. But Prakriti will drive you forward and you get to that. But that is still a level of ignorance. That is the apparent self. We have to step beyond it. Back to his essay. And so too, what we think of ordinarily as the soul is really the natural personality, not the true person, the Purusha, but the desire soul in us, which is a reflection of the consciousness of the Purusha in the workings of Prakriti. It is, in fact, itself only an action of the three modes and therefore a part of nature, belongs in the field of the gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas. Thus, there are, we may say, two souls in us, the apparent or desire soul, which changes with the mutations of the gunas and is entirely constituted and determined by them, and the free and eternal Purusha, not limited by nature and her gunas. We have two selves, the apparent self, which is only the ego, that mental center in us which takes up this mutable action of Prakriti, this mutable personality, and which says, I am this personality, I am this natural being who am doing these works. But the natural being is simply nature, a composite of the gunas, and the true self, which is indeed the upholder, the possessor, and the lord of nature and figured in her, but is not itself the mutable natural personality. Anumanta Bharata, etc. The way to be free must then be to get rid of the desires of this desire soul and the false self-view of this ego. Having become free from desire and egoism, cries the teacher, fight with all the fever of thy soul passed away from thee. Nirashir Nirmamo Bhutva. Chapter 3, Shloka 30. So remember, it's the dedication, the desireless dedication of the works that leads you beyond ego and desire into identity, and then you can do what Ishvara wishes to accomplish through you. And in Arjuna's case, it is to put down the darkness, to take up the bow and fight. This view of our being starts from the Sankhya analysis of the dual principle in our nature, Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is an active, a karta. Prakriti is active, kartri. Purusha is the being full of the light of consciousness. Prakriti is the nature, mechanical, reflecting all her works in the conscious witness, the Purusha. Prakriti works by the inequality of her three modes, gunas, in perpetual collision and intermixture and mutation with each other. And by her function of ego mind, she gets the Purusha to identify himself with all this working and so creates the sense of active, mutable, temporal personality in the silent eternity of the self. The impure natural consciousness overclouds the pure soul consciousness. The mind forgets the person in the ego and the personality. We suffer the discriminating intelligence to be carried away by the sense mind and its outgoing functions and by the desire of the life and the body. So long as the Purusha sanctions this action, ego and desire and ignorance must govern the natural being. So surely Sri Aurobindo has written about this earlier in his essays on the Gita. But remember that he's writing a journal, a monthly, a periodical. And so new readers come in and may not have the older issues with them. And so in a sense, he often has to restate what he has already said. It's part of the problem of having a monthly. But I think it doesn't hurt for us to read and reread the nature of the Samkhya philosophy and understand how things fit together within it, because the Gita takes that system and largely accepts it, not the later system that we've come to identify with the Samkhya Karikas, but the original Samkhya is used by the Gita and then developed, adapted, and bent to the Gita's larger will, because it has to serve a Vedantic end. So, what he's just described is how mind leans into the ego maker, becomes a nexus, becomes, in a sense, an entity, and then follows its way down the rest of the chain of nature, moving through desire towards the subtle and then the gross objects of the sense, therefore into material nature. So this is a cosmology which you might also say has a psychological origination involved in its view. Because what is true for the world is true for the individual. Microcosm, macrocosm. Back to his essay. But if this were all, then the only remedy would be to withdraw altogether the sanction, suffer or compel all our nature by this withdrawal to fall into a motionless equilibrium of the three gunas and so cease from all action. So the idea is that if that picture is complete that he just described, then all you could do is renounce it and back out of it. Cut your connection with Prakriti. Divorce Purusha from Prakriti. So let's read that again. But if this were all, then the only remedy would be to withdraw altogether the sanction, suffer or compel all our nature by this withdrawal to fall into a motionless equilibrium of the three gunas and so cease from all action. You can see what this would mean for the universe. If the soul, to be free, to be fully aware of itself, has to withdraw from the cosmos, then the cosmos will never change. Prakriti will continue on the way it works. There will be no evolution. There will be no development. Things never improve if the best among us, Shrestham, and remember, Arjuna is that, the best among humanity. If he withdraws, all is lost. We have to remain engaged. But this is precisely the remedy, though it is undoubtedly a remedy, one which abolishes, we might say, the patient along with the disease, which the Gita constantly discourages, especially. To resort to a tamasic inaction is just what the ignorant will do if this truth is thrust upon them. The discriminating mind in them will fall into a false division, a false opposition, buddhi-bheda, 326. Their active nature and their intelligence will be divided against each other and produce a disturbance and confusion without true issue. A false and self-deceiving line of action, mithyachara, 3.6. Or else, a mere tamasic inertia, cessation of works, diminution of the will to life and action, not, therefore, a liberation, but rather a subjection to the lowest of the three gunas, to tamas, the principle of ignorance and of inertia. Reminds you, does it not, of where Arjuna was, despondent, crushed, willing to leave the world. Let me just hie away, leave nature behind. I quit. I will not fight. Krishna, guide me. And Krishna guides him all the way back through an understanding of the nature of soul and works to the point where he has to take up the bow. Not quite yet. There's more to teach. But if you take the ordinary person, you try to offer them this metaphysical distinction, this Sankhian solution to the problems of life, they'll renounce, they'll become a monk, they'll go away, and the world doesn't improve. The Gita insists on engaging with life, but from the richness of the soul and not from the poverty of gross identification with nature. Or else they will not be able to understand at all. They will find fault with this higher teaching, assert against it their present mental experience, their ignorant idea of free will, and yet more confirmed by the plausibility of their logic in their bewilderment and the deception of ego and desire, lose their chance of liberation in a deeper, more obstinate confirmation of the ignorance. In fact, these higher truths can only be helpful because they are true to experience and can be lived on a higher and vaster plane of consciousness and being. To view these truths from below is to miss-see, misunderstand, and probably to misuse them. It is a higher truth that the distinction of good and evil is indeed a practical fact and law, valid for the egoistic human life, which is the stage of transition from the animal to the divine. But on a higher plane, we rise beyond good and evil, are above their duality, even as the Godhead is above it. But the unripe mind, seizing on this truth without rising from the lower consciousness, where it is not practically valid, will simply make it a convenient excuse for indulging its asuric propensities, denying the distinction between good and evil altogether, and falling by self-indulgence deeper into the morass of perdition. Sarva jnana vimudhan nashtan achetasaha. 332. So too, with this truth of the determinism of nature, it will be misseen and misused, as those misuse it who declare that a man is what his nature has made him, and cannot do otherwise than as his nature compels him. This is Epicurus. This is Lucretius. It is true in a sense, but not in the sense which is attached to it, not in the sense that the ego self can claim irresponsibility and impunity for itself in its works, for it has will and it has desire, and so long as it acts according to its will and desire, even though that be its nature, it must bear the reactions of its karma. It is in a net, if you will, a snare which may well seem perplexing, illogical, unjust, terrible to its present experience, to its limited self-knowledge, but a snare of its own choice, a net of its own weaving. You'll remember the child's protestation. I didn't do it. My hand did it. I think we can put a footnote to continue this discussion of free will versus determinism later. We'll put a bookmark there in the passage and turn to Savitri. Here's a section in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. This is going to begin on page 83. All was uncovered to his seeless eye, a secret nature stripped of her defense. Once in a dreaded half-light formidable, overtaken in her mighty privacy, lay bare to the burning splendor of his will. In shadowy chambers lit by a strange sun, and opening hardly to hid mystic keys, her perilous arcanes and hooded powers confessed the advent of a mastering mind and bore the compulsion of a time-born gaze. Incalculable in their wizard modes, immediate and invincible in the act, her secret strengths native to greater worlds, lifted above our needy limited scope, the occult privilege of demigods, and the sure power pattern of her cryptic signs, her diagrams of geometric force, her potencies of marvel-fraught design, courted employment by an earth-nursed might. A conscious nature's quick machinery, armed with a latent splendor of miracle, the prophet passion of a seeing mind, and the lightning bareness of a free soul force. All once impossible deemed could now become a natural limb of possibility, a new domain of normalcy supreme. An almighty occultist erects in space this seeming outward world which tricks the sense. He weaves his hidden threads of consciousness. He builds bodies for his shapeless energy. Out of the unformed and vacant vast, he has made his sorcery of solid images, his magic of formative number and design, the fixed irrational links none can annul, this crisscross tangle of invisible laws. His infallible rules, his covered processes, achieve unerringly an inexplicable creation where our error carves dead frames of knowledge for a living ignorance. In her mystery's moods, divorced from the Maker's laws, she too as sovereignly creates her field, her will shaping the undetermined vasts, making a finite of infinity. She too can make an order of her caprice, as if her rash superb wagered to outvie the veiled creator's cosmic secrecies. So we'll end there. Thank you all for joining. Namaste. Jai Ma. Be well.